Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. This week's shows are drawn from some of the great conversations I had at the recent NVIDIA GPU Technology Conference, and they're brought to you by Dell. If you caught my tweets from GTC, you may already know that one of the announcements this year was a new reference architecture for data science workstations powered by high-end GPUs and accelerated software such as NVIDIA's RAPIDS. Dell was among the key partners showcased during the launch and offers a line of workstations designed for modern machine learning and AI workloads. To learn more about Dell Precision Workstations and some of the ways they're being used by customers in industries like media and entertainment, engineering and manufacturing, healthcare and life sciences, oil and gas, and financial services, visit dellemc.com/precision. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Gerald Kwan. Gerald is an assistant professor at UC Davis. Gerald, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thanks for the invitation to interview with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to diving into some of the work that you've been doing around applying deep learning to genomics. But before we do that, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background and how you started working in the intersection of those two fields.
So I guess my career in computational biology started out in my first year of undergrad, actually, where I was initially slated to enter a computer science undergraduate program. And about 2 weeks before I started, I got a piece of paper in the mail from my university telling me that they started a new bioinformatics program and were wondering if I was interested in joining. And I initially turned them down because I thought the idea of kind of studying biology with computers was didn't seem that interesting. But after a couple semesters, I just happened to meet a professor doing some really interesting kind of high throughput data analysis, looking at proteins and their kind of three-dimensional structures. And he was interested in kind of predicting these 3D structures from their kind of linear protein sequence. And it just kind of piqued my interest. And from there, I never really looked back.
And so do you currently sit in which department at Davis?
So I'm in the Department of Molecular and Cell Bio, which is a little bit of it's kind of an interesting place to be because my undergrad, again, was kind of in computer science, bioinformatics, and then I took a brief break and went to biochemistry, tried to do a master's in biochemistry before I went back to computer science for my PhD. And I think this kind of background where I have a little bit of biology and a little bit of computer science background kind of appealed to my department. And so that's kind of how I ended up here.
Awesome. Awesome. And so you were recently at the NVIDIA GTC conference where you gave a presentation on deep domain adaptation and generative models for single cell genomics. What's the main challenge that you're talking about in that presentation?
Well, so basically in the field of kind of molecular biology, these kind of genomics technologies are the biologist's way of kind of getting really high resolution snapshots of different kinds of like human tissues and so on. And the work that I spoke about specifically is kind of on this emerging field called single cell genomics, where you can actually do these measurements on individual cells, whereas kind of historically you had to kind of use like really big tissues in order to get enough sample to generate this data. And so it's kind of exciting because because you can do measurements on these single cells, you can generate vast orders of magnitude more data than you could previously. And so now, whereas before, when you look at kind of human data, you could only generate data for, say, like a couple hundred tissues or samples. Now we can generate like millions of data for millions of samples. And so that it's really exciting because we can sort of apply a lot of the kind of methods from like deep learning and so on, because we have this large amount of data that we didn't previously have.
What are some of the things that you're trying to understand through these analyses or diseases that you're trying to identify or fight?
We try to study a couple of diseases of interest. So these include things like cancer and Alzheimer's disease and schizophrenia. And so the basic premise is that, if you want to kind of understand how say a disease like schizophrenia works, you know, you kind of want to take say samples from brain tissues from sort of so-called healthy normal people, and you want to take them from these, you know, say people with schizophrenia, and then you want to somehow be able to compare you know, the data that you get from both of these groups of patients in order to figure out what changed when you know, when schizophrenia happens at different stages. And so in sort of this in our work that we presented at the GTC, the tool that we developed was specifically designed to basically build models of genomic data in both kind of normal people and schizophrenia people, and then kind of use techniques from domain adaptation to kind of understand how the two are related.
And this is maybe a more domain-specific question, but for something like schizophrenia, it strikes me as more of a systemic problem than a, you know, something that you would see in a single cell. What's the connection?
So you're right. So, you know, complex diseases like schizophrenia have, you know, there's many factors that contribute to the development of schizophrenia. In our particular work, we try to look at whole regions of the brain and how these whole regions may change between normal and people with schizophrenia. And so the reason why this single cell stuff is really interesting is because previously, if you wanted to, like, we know that in the brain, there's like lots of different types of cells and tissues in there. And so previously, when people did these kind of studies, they could only take, say, an entire brain, kind of chop it up, and then look at a snapshot of the whole brain and compare whole normal versus whole schizophrenic. But now, because we can measure things at single cell, we can measure like millions of cells in a single normal person, millions of cells in a single schizophrenia person, and then try to compare and say, okay, of these million cells I got from one normal, one schizophrenic person, which subset of these million cells is actually changing? Because not everything in the brain will change when you get schizophrenia.
And so we've talked about genomics here. Is the data that you're fundamentally looking at, is it sequence data, or is it some kind of imaging data, or a combination of the two?
So the data that sort of comes from the biologist comes in the form of DNA or RNA sequence from these patients, but that kind of gets converted in this kind of data pre-processing step, such that the data that we look at essentially is just it just boils down to matrices, where like columns of these matrices correspond to different cells from, say, a patient, and rows represent kind of different features of the cells that are measured through genomics.
So a feature, an example of a feature being like a known sequence or something, the existence of a known sequence or a SNP or something like that?
So it actually corresponds to like a gene. And so the idea is that when you look at a cell within, a patient, you can make many different types of measurements on the cells, but one common type of measurement is called a gene expression measurement. So the idea is that, you know, you have each cell has DNA in it, but DNA by itself usually acts as kind of just a storage mechanism. And so for DNA to do anything, it actually large parts of it get converted to this molecule called RNA. And so what we're measuring, what each feature is measuring, is how much of this kind of active RNA molecule gets produced from each part of the DNA. And so that's how we get like a vector for each cell, where each component corresponds to how much activity we see from a given part of the genome.
Okay. And so where does domain adaptation and generative models, where do those come into your workflow here?
So the GTC talk was basically discussing two different projects. So in terms of domain adaptation, the problem we were trying to solve there is that essentially the problem is when you look at these features of cells in normal versus schizophrenia people, one of the most common first tasks that people do when they get this kind of data is they will do some, you know, dimensionality reduction, and they'll sort of visualize these cells that they get from these normal and schizophrenic people. And the first thing that you notice when you do this visualization is that all of the cells that you collect from normal people separate very distinctly from the cells that you get from schizophrenia people. And now this is kind of a problem because the your underlying goal is you have these different types of cells represented in the normal and the schizophrenia people, and you ideally want to kind of in an unsupervised way match the right cell types from the normal and the schizophrenia people so that you can figure out for each type of cell how are they different across the two populations. And so we basically perform domain adaptation to take these cells that kind of look very different overall between normal and schizophrenic people and kind of merge them together such that cells of the same type basically look very similar to each other. And so we can kind of match them across these two groups of people. So the adaptation really is in basically building model to say, okay, given this is what my data from the normal people look like, given this is what the data from the schizophrenic people look like, can I kind of match them such that the distribution of my cells in this feature space basically overlap?
And so when you say the data looks very different between these two groups, in what sense? I mean, in some sense, that's what you want if you're trying to build a classifier that can determine whether a given cell indicates schizophrenia, for example. But it sounds like that's not the part of the process that you're working on here.
So I guess just to be more clear, there are both kind of very large scale differences between normal and schizophrenic people. And then there's very kind of smaller changes that are specific to each type of cell that is different between normal and schizophrenic people. And so in a typical kind of analysis, you want to first kind of characterize what are those very big changes that cause these two different types of, these cells from these two types of people to reside in different regions of this feature space. And then conditioned on understanding what those big changes are, you want to then take away the effect of that big change such that now you can look at individual cell types and then ask, okay, for these individual groups of cells that are common between normal and schizophrenia, what's different about them?
What's the approach for doing that?
There's been some previous work published, basically these class of models called associative domain adaptation have previously been developed. And so in the associative domain adaptation problem, the problem they're trying to solve is that they basically envision that you have, say, two different data sets where you're trying to perform the same task. So they assume that you're trying to do classification in data set one and classification in data set two. And they assume that you have, you have the same labels that you're trying to classify in both data sets. Now, what the assumption that the original associative domain adaptation makes is that although the labels that you're trying to classify are the same, the distribution of the data is different. So given your feature space, the data in one data set sits in a different region of the feature space than the other. And so their domain adaptation approach was designed to basically try to essentially learn kind of common features that are predictive of the same labels across these two different data sets. And so our approach is basically similar in the sense that we have data in sort of two different regions of the feature space corresponding to normal and schizophrenia. But in our case, we're trying to do an unsupervised analysis. So we're trying to group cells that come from these two different domains, but we think represent the same cell type. And so we basically modified their supervised domain adaptation approach to do unsupervised clustering across two data sets. And so the way that the approach works is that it's a deep neural network, and it looks for all intents and purposes like an autoencoder. So, the first half of the network takes the data in the original feature space and it projects it down to a low dimensional manifold. And then the second half of the network takes the low dimensional manifold and projects it back into some high dimensional space. But kind of unlike a typical autoencoder where the loss function that you're optimizing, can be something like, say, squared error. What our loss function is and what the other domain adaptation loss function is we try to find a low dimensional embedding of the different cells such that the marginal distribution of the cells in the latent space overlap between the two data sets as much as possible. And so there's no kind of notion of kind of squared loss or reconstruction loss that we're trying to optimize here. It's really just trying to match the marginal distributions of the cells in the low dimensional embedding space between the two different data sets.
And so this embedding space that you're creating when you're trying to overlap the two, that's essentially the domain adaptation aspect of this. Is that right?
Exactly. We're essentially adapting like one domain to another. We're distorting one set of cells to match the marginal distribution of the other.
So where does the domain adaptation fit in your overall kind of end-to-end experimentation?
Well, so what we do is we take the cells from the two different groups. We do this adaptation to bring them into the same region of the feature space. And that then allows us to match for an individual cell-by-cell basis. We can say, okay, this cell in the normal person corresponds to exactly this normal cell in the schizophrenic person. And then that then allows us downstream to then look at those individual cells paired across normal and schizophrenic people and ask the question, how are they different in terms of the original features?
And when you're talking about looking at these different types of cells pre and post adaptation, are you taking the output of the domain adaptation and using that to train a model, or is it for more manual analysis?
So one thing that I didn't quite discuss yet is I said that we train this network to learn an embedding, a shared embedding space for both kind of the normal and schizophrenic people. But what I didn't talk about is that the other half of the network is still a decoder, and it's a decoder in the traditional sense where we learn the encoder separately, and then after we learn the shared embedding space, we train decoders to take cells from this shared embedding space and project them back into the normal versus schizophrenic data set. And so this is important for the following reason. So the reason why domain adaptation is necessary for this kind of genomic analysis is that in the ideal biological experiment, you would be able to take a normal cell, you would be able to kind of assay its, make those high dimensional measurements. You would then be able to kind of give it schizophrenia in some sense, and then measure its activity again. And so in that sense, you'd be able to take exactly the same cell with kind of before and after you've applied this phenotype, this disease phenotype, and then see exactly what change occurred in that cell due to this stimulus. And so this isn't possible in real biology because to kind of make these high dimensional measurements, you have to kill the cell. And so you can't measure the same cell twice. But because we can train decoders which take any cell in this shared embedding space, project it to normal or schizophrenia, we can now kind of simulate what would happen if you took one cell and you gave it either, you made it either a normal cell or a schizophrenia cell. And so now we can treat these projections as paired data and then ask on a per cell basis, how do they differ between these two conditions. And so getting back to your original question, we don't, the downstream analysis is still kind of somewhat manual, but we are kind of trying to do something a little bit smarter by using these decoders to kind of simulate these biological experiments that we can't do.
Right, right. But ultimately, you're not trying to like train a classifier to determine, given a cell, whether it's normal or schizophrenic or not. It's more using the domain adaptation to allow you to more kind of manually compare the characteristics of these two types of cells absent the kind of broad spectrum differences between the two.
Yeah.
So that's the domain adaptation piece. And then you're using generative models as a part of this as well. Where do they come in?
Right. And so the idea behind these generative models is that one of the kind of really hot research areas in biology right now is to kind of try to understand how cells work together, right? And so, there's kind of this big focus on, okay, can we, do these genomic measurements on these individual single cell levels? But part of the thing is that when you look at like, a disease like cancer, for example, cancer is not really just kind of a collection of individual cancer cells doing their own thing. They're kind of, there's a lot of crosstalk between them. They're kind of helping each other out to kind of, you know, metastasize and so on. And so the idea of our generative model is that we kind of want to, is that, you know, it's very easy nowadays to take cells in isolation and, you know, measure their genomics profile to see what they're doing. And it's also easy to take a collection of them together when they're working together and measure as a whole, you know, what they're doing. And so now what we're trying to do is we're trying to develop models where generative models, where we have generative models for each individual cell based on measurements we make on single cell level. And then these component generative models essentially inform a very larger generative model, which try to explain what happens when you put them all together, if that makes sense. And so we're basically learning these nested generative models to say, okay, what can we learn about cells in isolation? And then can we explain how they work together and why that's different from just the sum of the individual components itself?
Wow, there's a lot there. So these nested generative models, are they end-to-end trained, or are you training them on a cell-by-cell basis and then kind of ensembling or aggregating to create the system level?
So we're basically training them end-to-end by optimizing. So basically, for example, the component generative models that kind of handle what generating individual cell types look like, those are influenced both by our data on the individual cells themselves, as well as kind of the cells altogether. Whereas the other pieces of the bigger model that take the individual components and somehow add them together, those are only influenced by the data on kind of the bulk cells, all of the cells together. And so we kind of try to optimize them all. We try to optimize the parameters of all of these parts of the network at the same time.
And so is the starting, the underlying data set that you're using to build up these generative models, is it the same type of data that we discussed previously for the domain adaptation piece?
Right. So the type of data used to train the individual generative models of each cell type are the same type of data as we just talked about with the domain adaptation. The type of data that we collect to measure how they're working together is actually from an older technology. So kind of genomics technologies that don't work on single cell levels, but they work on measuring genomics of a collection of cells together. And so we're kind of mixing data that are kind of from a newer generation and an older generation.
What type of GAN approach did you use for this?
So we started out with variational autoencoders, actually. We tried different variants of variational autoencoders. It turns out for this specific problem, in terms of performance, the specific variant didn't seem to make such a big difference. But we are also trying more recently to kind of combine. So, I mean, a number of people have looked at this before, but use like deep graphical models, where again, like the generative models are, you know, they use proper probability distributions, but they also use neural networks in there as well.
So the variational autoencoder, you started this project using variational autoencoders for your generative models. But then did you ultimately evolve to using more of a GAN type of a model?
We actually have tried, we've tried GANs in the past. We found they were a little bit more difficult to train. And so part of the issue we have in the field of computational biology is that we're building these models in part to try to understand something about biology and disease. But also a lot of these kind of problems, so this, the problem that we're trying to solve with these generative models is what's called deconvolution. The problem of deconvolution arises in many different areas of biology as well. And so part of what we're trying to do is also develop kind of usable software that bench biologists who may not have a lot of experience training neural nets, for example, can easily just kind of pick up and apply to their own problems. And so we found that when comparing VAEs versus GANs, the VAE-based models were easier for other people to train and use on their own data, whereas the GANs seem to be much harder to get to work out of the box.
Got it.
And so I guess from a more practical perspective, we our current models are based on VAEs just because it's easier to give to other people to use on their own problems.
And so you've got the domain adaptation piece and the generative models. Do those then come together as part of this pipeline, or are they just both tools in your tool bag that you use to study these cells and the conditions that create them?
So they're basically two related but distinct tools that we're using on similar problems. So we're basically part of a project called the Human Cell Atlas, whose goal is in part to kind of characterize human tissues and organs at the single cell level and characterize how they look under normal and disease conditions. And so both of these tools, one which enables comparison of data collected under different experiments, which is the domain adaptation, and the other, deconvolution, which is a tool to help us understand why are human tissues not just collections of their individual components. I sort of see both of these tools as, ways to study the same problem, essentially.
Are there examples you can share of insights that these tools ultimately led to?
Up to now, we've basically been working mostly on kind of the development aspect of this tool. So we've been developing it and kind of validating that it works on, data sets with known ground truths. And so now we're kind of in the process of applying these tools in a number of different ways. And so to give you an example of, maybe a more practical application of this tool, we're working, one problem we're looking at, we're trying to understand how, for example, these malaria parasites, transmit themselves across various populations. And so, the thing about malaria is that malaria is kind of an interesting parasite because it has this like life cycle where for a single parasite, at the end of this life cycle, it has to make a decision, do I asexually reproduce or do I sexually reproduce and therefore, which therefore leads to transmission. And so kind of understanding, if you can get a good grasp of how these malaria parasites decide when and how to transmit to other hosts, then you could potentially develop therapies to stop it. And so that's in this specific problem, we were working with some other scientists to basically compare malaria parasites that were undergoing kind of sexual or asexual reproduction and doing this domain adaptation to then ask the question, at what point do these malaria parasites, going down two different fates change? And so by applying this tool, we identified a small set of genes, which now we think if we kind of delete these genes from the malaria or somehow inhibit them from working, we might be able to stop their transmission. But this kind of work is still, the downstream application of these tools is still kind of something that we're now just getting into now that we've kind of established that the tools are working.
Well, certainly the application to malaria could be hugely impactful if we're able to identify and kind of stop that, whatever the sequence is. The transmission, obviously the transmission, but whatever the mechanism is that is causing the transmission. Were there other things that you covered in your presentation that it would make sense to jump into?
So I think, one of the things that we briefly touched on that we're really excited about is kind of the use of machine learning to do what people sometimes call like multimodal data integration. And so the idea here is that sort of in biology, again, a lot of people, including my research lab, we do a lot of analyses at kind of like the DNA level, which is kind of very low level. And we, our goal is always to somehow tie what happens at the low level to, the big things like, are you going to get a disease or not? But, tying these low-level events to these high-level things like disease incidence is sometimes really hard because there's a lot of steps between, things that happen at DNA level and things that happen at, the whole human level. And so nowadays, there's kind of more and more interest in people collecting data from the same kinds of cells or tissues at both kind of like the DNA level and at the whole cell level and at the kind of tissue level, and then trying to link all of these things together such that we can, instead of just trying to predict, okay, if something happened, if this event happens to DNA, you know, am I going to get disease? Now we can try to predict, okay, if something happens at the DNA level, does that somehow change how my like tissues are organized or how my brain is like structured? And then how does that then kind of impact disease? And so I think, you know, for example, we're working with some people at the Allen Institute for Brain Science, where they're kind of they're doing some really cool experiments where they can take certain types of brain cells and they can use like electrophysiology, or, you know, they can take pictures of the cell to look at their shape and then also measure what's happening at the genome level. And so now we're trying to build models which can basically tie together things at the DNA level, at the kind of electrophysiology level, and at the imaging level to try to get a better understanding of how do events at the DNA change our risk of disease. And so this is you know, this is kind of exciting because, you know, now we, you know, there's obviously tons and tons of work in the computer vision field for doing things like, you know, doing all things related to image processing and, you know, understanding images. And so now we can, you know, our goal over the next few years is to try to incorporate, you know, what's happening in like computer vision with, you know, our work in sort of genomics, along with, you know, what people have been doing modeling neuroscience data, and try to put it all together to try to kind of really understand what's happening in biology and the human cell.
Well, very interesting work, Gerald. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us about it.
Yep, definitely. Thanks, Sam.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on any of the shows in our GTC 2019 series, visit twimlai.com/GTC19. Thanks again to Dell for sponsoring this series. Be sure to check them out at dellemc.com/precision. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.